Back chat.
Politics and current affairs.
Back chat.
Woo. Your alternative to talk back.
That's right. You are listening to Backchat here on FBI Radio, your freshest wrap of news and current affairs. I'm Swetha Das.
And I'm Amber Schultz, filling in for Shami. This week in the news, we've seen the third Democratic presidential debate and Donald Trump seemingly forget that he had a younger son. Yikes. But as always, we're going to be giving you the news that you might not have heard on your airwaves this week.
That's right. First up, we have Dr. Nicole Lee, a professor at Curtin University's National Drug Research Institute, to chat about the federal government's proposal to drug test welfare recipients.
After that, we'll be speaking to Michael Rodriguez, who's on the chair of the Nighttime Industries Association by night, and by day he runs the magazine Time Out. He'll be discussing the New South Wales government's decision to wind back Sydney's lockout laws.
But that's not all, because finally on the show we're going to have Michelle Grace Hunder joining us to talk about Her Sound, Her Story doco, which explores women in Australia's music scene, which is being released next Friday. But we also have our wonderful FBI supporter drive going on right now. You know, here at FBI Radio, we've made a commitment to support emerging Sydney artists and foster a strong local culture. So please do consider becoming a supporter and call in on 833-22-945. That's 833-22-945.
To show us all what a beep lying, beep backstabbing, beep treacherous, beep beep she is. Thanks. Colin.
Backchat, your alternative to talk back.
Scott Morrison's government has revived controversial legislation that would force 5,000 Newstart and Youth Allowance recipients to undergo drug testing to get their welfare payments.
The coalition has framed the plan as part of the Prime Minister's compassionate conservatism. But the proposal is reviled by welfare groups and health experts who point to overseas evidence as proof the idea is ill-conceived and counterproductive.
Now, we have drug policy expert Dr. Nicole Lee from Curtin University's National Drug Research Institute here to discuss the legislation and help us understand exactly what's going on.
Hi there, Nicole.
Morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, can you give us an overview of what this drug testing legislation will look like?
Yeah, so the proposal is pretty similar to the last two attempts to get it through the Senate. It's framed as a two-year trial. It's 5,000 new recipients from next year who go onto Newstart and Youth Allowance, and they're testing for a range of drugs in three key locations: Queensland, New South Wales, and Western Australia. The locations are kind of more or less known drug hotspots for. Around Australia. So the only difference is that from the previous legislation is that cocaine has now been added to the list. So the list now includes methamphetamine, ecstasy, opioids like heroin, cannabis and cocaine. And anyone who tests positive will be put on income management. So 80% of their income will be quarantined, and they'll only have free rein to spend 20% of it. And then if they do test positive, they'll need to take a second test within 25 days. And if you have two positive tests, you get referred to a medical professional for assessment and possible treatment.
Wow, so it's pretty strict. Now, you have to do two tests, but how reliable could we expect these tests to be?
Well, it depends on what they're going to be using for tests. So the tests are reasonably reliable within a time frame to pick up a range of drugs, but that time frame is usually about 2 to 3 days. So if you've used about 2 to 3 days before the test, you might get picked up on most drugs. Urine tests or blood tests are probably the most accurate, but urine tests are probably the most accurate out of all of the easy tests to do. And we don't know whether they'll be on-the-spot urine tests or they'll be sent to the lab for detailed analysis, which is much more accurate. Mm.
So do we know of any legitimate links between drug use and unemployment?
So there's the first thing to keep in mind is that use of drugs is different from having a problem with drugs. Not everybody has a problem with drugs who uses them. In fact, the large proportion of people who use drugs, even on a relatively regular basis, aren't dependent on them and don't have any other significant long-term problems. So there is not a link between using drugs and drug seeking. There may be some links between having a problem with drugs and a whole range of other social issues, including getting back into work.
And have efforts to drug test welfare payments worked in other countries that have implemented it?
Well, this is the big problem for us in Australia, that it has actually been trialled in several countries across the world, including our cousins in New Zealand, and none of them have shown much either economic benefit or benefit for the person using drugs. So there was a Canadian study when they implemented their drug testing of welfare recipients, and it really just found that it was very expensive and there was only a very marginal increase in employment among welfare recipients who were tested. So for the cost of it, there's much better ways to get people to return to work. And New Zealand originally had a look at a similar scheme to Australia, and they ended up abandoning it for a whole range of practical and ideological reasons, which our government should certainly be paying attention to. What they ended up doing was subsequently modifying the drug testing of welfare recipients to instead just subsidise pre-employment testing where that was already required. When they did that, they tested more than 8,000 people and only got 22 positive results back. So it's a lot of expense of testing a whole range of people, putting them through that what's not a very pleasant process, and marginalising them and stigmatising them for very, very few positive results.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5 FM with Swetha Das and Amber Schultz. We're speaking with Dr. Nicole Lee from Curtin University about the proposal to drug test New Start and youth allowance recipients. Now, Nicole, this policy doesn't have, I guess, a lot of evidence to support it. So why do you think the coalition is pursuing it so doggedly?
Look, it's probably a question for the government rather than for me. But I think sometimes when people pursue ideas, especially in the drug field, that are not evidence-based, it's because they have a particular ideology about drugs. And usually that ideology is that drugs are bad and we should try and eliminate drug use in society. But I think that we know from a very, very long history in Australia and around the world that that will be impossible, and we have to take a much more pragmatic and compassionate approach to people who use drugs and people who have problems with them.
And so what could activist groups do to block this legislation to make sure it doesn't become law?
Well, there has been, unlike the last two attempts at legislation, this time around there has been a lot of lobbying and some protesting by people in the drug and alcohol sector and in the welfare sector, which I think is a good thing, just to raise awareness about it. And certainly, you know, doing the usual things like writing to your local member and protesting about it would be a helpful thing to do.
So what are some legitimate concerns that the bill raises that we should consider as the legislation goes through Parliament?
Sorry, I missed that question.
So I guess, like, what are some of the legitimate concerns that the bill raises that, you know, we should consider as it goes through Parliament in our discourse about it?
Yeah, look, I think the biggest thing from my point of view is the government wants to get people back into work, that's what they've said, and they want to help people who have drug problems. And the problem is that this legislation doesn't do either of those things. We know that from research around the world. So if they really wanted to get people back into work, the best thing to do is actually to put more money into drug treatment, because we know that the people who use drugs who don't have a problem with them, that's not a barrier to job seeking. But if people who do have a problem with them, then getting them into treatment is a much better option, and providing treatment. Now, the problem is, And the problem is, at the moment, that treatment is only funded at about half of what's required. So the first thing is that it's not going to actually do what the government wants it to do. The second thing is that these kind of measures marginalise and stigmatise people who use drugs and people who are on welfare. And they're already vulnerable people who, you know, if you've ever been unemployed and had to go on welfare, it's a humbling experience. And we don't, it's unhelpful to stigmatise this group of people because they are actually less likely to seek help and to get a job if we do that.
That's absolutely true. Thank you so much for chatting with us this morning. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Nicole Lee, a professor at Curtin University's National Drug Research Institute.
That's right. Stay tuned because we'll be moving along to our next interview with Michael Rodriguez from the Nighttime Industries Association and cultural magazine Time Out. Now, guys, I do not want us to forget we are having a supporter drive. Now, when I'm not playing Cardi B, I'm playing local Australian music. That is right. FBI Radio plays 50% Australian music and half of that comes from Sydney. No other station has an equal commitment to supporting local music like we do here at FBI Radio. So please call in to support us on 833-22945. That's 833-22945.
The Australian taxpayer even pays for the toilet paper she uses. Does she go down to the chemist to buy the tampons? Or is the Australian taxpayer paying for those as well?
Fact Chat, your alternative to talk back.
Sydney's controversial lockout laws could be scrapped for most of the CBD, with the New South Wales Premier hoping the move will enhance the city's nightlife.
Gladys Berejiklian will move to lift the 1:30 a.m. lockout laws in the CBD Entertainment District, but the law will remain in place for King's Cross.
So why King's Cross? Why that one area with a ton of residential development? I have some beef to squash. I'm definitely not biased in this conversation. Today we have Michael Rodriguez, who campaigned against Sydney's lockout laws with the Nighttime Industries Association, here to answer all our pressing questions and maybe a conspiracy theory or two from me. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure too. So how did you get involved with the campaign to take down Sydney's lockout laws?
I think there's been a lot of displeasure around those changes that occurred some time back. And, you know, running Time Out, which is all about going out and having fun in the city. If you can't have fun in the city, then sort of what's the point of a Time Out? And so I think, you know, we talked about it and gave it quite a bit of coverage, you know, in the early years. But after all, I kind of just got sick and tired of talking about it myself and thought we've got to go on, you know, materially try and impact this and fix the situation. Because like many of the other issues that we face in society generally, you have, I think, a political class that's somewhat disconnected from what's actually going on. And things are moving quite quickly on a number of issues. The last call was an example of that. And it's the voices of bartenders who aren't lobbyists, who communicate on Facebook, chefs who communicate on Twitter, all these things, where are those voices going into the political system? And so Time Out has a pretty good grassroots knowledge of arts, culture, music, food, and we just realised that a lot of those stories weren't getting into the decision makers and into policy. And and what's that Lily Tomlin quote? It's like if I used to say somebody should do something about that, and then you realise you're somebody. So if it wasn't going to be the guy running Time Out that kind of took that fight on, then who was it in the city? That kind of really took off in earnest a couple of years ago. And it's really just been about not trying to reinvent the wheel of what other people in the space are doing, i.e. Keeps in the Open, the City of Sydney, Committee for Sydney. It's been about really trying to get one voice from industry into the political system that our decision makers can rely on as being representative, because I don't think that there's any sort of, wider, nastier plan here. I just think it's a lack of information and a lack of clarity. And to the extent that you look at the nighttime sector, it's actually comprised of a lot of competing interests. You know, there's hospitality businesses that compete with music businesses that compete with other types of performance. How well do they work together, and how well do they go in and say to government, actually, here's the two or three things that would really shift the needle for us as a sector? And I don't think anyone was doing that. Not not for any ill purpose, just that wasn't happening. And so that's kind of led to the formation of the Nighttime Industries Association. And the only problem is if you have a good idea, then people say, well, you should chair that as well. So I've ended up with my day job, as I say, then running time out and then by night trying to fix the city.
It's a personal call to arms. What do you think about the New South Wales government decision to wind the lockout laws back?
Yeah, so I guess it's kind of a bit of misinformation, I would say, going on at the moment. Like, there is no formal decision. I guess I would say that the Premier has signalled her intention around changes that may come, and I guess it'd be hard for her to resile away from, you know, lifting lockout in the lower CBD now, but not impossible. We've got a parliamentary report that comes out on the 30th of September that a number of participants in this space have been, you know, involved in that inquiry, and it will contain, I imagine, a number of recommendations. And I think, you know, that will then go through a process of government response. And then any legislation, I think, earliest you'd see that is October, November. And so, you know, as and when change happens, it could be 3 months, 2 to 3 months, or even, you know, 6 months away. Yeah.
So I just want to be real here, Michael.
Sure.
Okay. You know, you've been campaigning against the lockout laws for many years. You know, we had a state election where there was even a Keep Sydney Open political party. Mm. We've been hearing about this for a long time. And then suddenly, midweek, where no one has been talking about this, I wake up and there's a notification. The Premier is putting her support behind getting rid of the lockout laws. Why has this suddenly come up? Like, is there a legitimate reason for why it's suddenly come up?
I don't know. When I guess my point is I'm happy that they're looking to change. I'd say that maybe I'm discovering the difference between politics and policy, if you get my drift. The timing of it 2 weeks out from the report might look peculiar, but also, you know, if you put yourself, I think, in the position of the Premier, it's like, well, if the report's likely to come out in favour of making these recommendations, then one way to do is to get on the right side of that debate, because otherwise they'll be antagonistic from people like on our side who are campaigning for things, and obviously like her opposition. So, you know, I'm kind of saving off value judgments as to the timing.
I'm cynical though, because I think like she's always faced backlash, right? From, you know,
everything.
People. Yeah. So, what, you know, suddenly she's like, oh, I am actually scared of the Nighttime Industries Association.
Well, you know, I just think it's one of those things where, I mean, if you go back, so part of the reason it formed, right, is that the debate prior to the formation of the Nighttime Industries Association had been about police, alcohol, violence and health. And the problem with that, those terms are just political kryptonite for everybody, because as soon as you're just talking about those things, the police and health professionals will come out and say, any Premier who removes this will have blood on the streets, blah, 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 and then no action. By changing the discussion to one about nighttime economy, city vibrancy, arts, culture, it's painted a different narrative for Sydney, which is what we're trying to do. And if you have a debate on those terms, then lockout is seen in context of the restrictions it's placing on that economy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the word lockout just confined all manner of evil just to one word, polarised people. And we're really talking about, you know, to some of the thinking around King's Cross, it's kind of like got now this historical legacy issue that I think the medical professionals are kind of attached to, understandably, because coalface dealing with that. And, you know, we're talking about, yes, the unfortunate deaths, but, you know, like every night for our paramedics and police in that area, I would say it's like you could understand their perspective. Now, the issue is that the Cross has changed substantially. I think there's only 5 existing hotel licences. Of the 29 high-risk venues, I think there's only maybe 14 now in operation. You've commented on real estate developments in the area, which means that any change of use to properties now will be objected to by residents. You know, the city's found a new way to entertain itself in other precincts. So if you ask me, I'm saying my position is, well, yeah, like, go and let's look at the facts of King's Cross right now. It isn't the same location.
No.
And no one has a desire, I think, to see it go back to 2014. You know, it's a different time. Entertainment habits have changed, particularly in young audiences. One of my big frustrations with this whole debate is at age 43, I'm one of the youngest voices actually having an impact. And it's just, you know, we're trying to plan future nightlife for my kids, aged, you know, 6 and 3, and, you know, who's doing it? People age 60 who don't go out, and their memories are of an era where bad behaviour was part of a night out. I grew up in Sydney Southwest, and, you know, coming into the city as a man of colour, into the rocks, was like taking life into your own hands, because, you know, you're more than like, you know, likely to end up in some sort of altercation.
It has changed so much since a few years ago, 5 years ago even. You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5 FM with Swetha Das and Amber Schultz. We're speaking to Michael Rodriguez, who campaigned against Sydney's lockout laws with the Nighttime Industries Association, speaking to us about the laws being scrapped. Now, why do you think King's Cross has been left out of the equation, given that it's changed? Do you think it's fair?
I don't, and as I
as we're just speaking about, you know, it feels like they are being picked on for a certain reason. And I think here at Backchat, we'd like to kind of dismantle some of the conspiracy theories I have about it.
Go for it.
So, I mean, you would remember there was a big petition against having a 24-hour Hungry Jack's.
Yep.
And then now they've built a 19-storey residential property across the road. And apparently in 2016, a $500 million property deal was signed. So do you think that there's some sort of... I don't want to put words in your mouth. You tell me. But is there some sort of, like, lobbyist group? Or, like, some sort of powerful, rich force that's just, you know, trying to make King's Cross the next Double Bay?
Yeah, I think it's a King's... you know, maybe, but also it's a metaphor for, I think, how Sydney works. Like, if you look at developments like Barangaroo and others, these things, I always feel like there's conversations going on way above my pay grade in the city between large business. And, you know, we're just trying to, you know, get involved in some way to shape things. And, yeah, I guess, you know, Joe Sidoti's in the press at the moment, you know, with... And I'm not going to comment on that, but, like, it's, you know, there's stuff going on, isn't there? And so I guess it's sad, but I think you have to look for where the opportunities are and try and, you know, rally people around impacting as best you can and provide a different alternative, you know, because maybe part of the thinking is we don't want murder and mayhem on the streets. Why don't we turn it into a massive residential area because it'll be safer, you know? Well, actually, it's not an either-or decision, is it? You can have city vibrancy and safety.
That's absolutely true.
So just very quickly, people have texted in because this is a very hot subject. People have said that the government has achieved what they set out to do, gentrify the areas for developers. Someone else has texted in saying someone needs to fight over the light rail budget in the area. Another person said that it seems suspect that this is all happening. So people are confirming my conspiracy theories. And, some people have sent in some nasty messages about our premier, but so I'm not going to read them out loud.
Those ones.
But it seems like the majority of people are very cynical about the lockout laws. And I think that as we see the bill going through Parliament with the premier backing it, we might find out a bit more about what are the motivations behind this change.
I think we will. Thank you so much for talking with us this morning, Michael.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
That was Michael Rodriguez, who campaigned against Sydney's lockout laws with the Nighttime Industries Association. Don't go anywhere, because we've got our final interview about women and music with Michelle Grace Hunder. Here's Godspeed by Frank Ocean.
Absolutely laughable. The woman's off her tree.
Backchat, your alternative to talk back.
A moving documentary exploring women in Australia's music scene is being released next Friday. Her Sound, Her Story is an intimate conversation with 45 artists spanning 6 decades discussing the experiences, triumphs and social impact of women in the industry.
It's being released online alongside a documentary from 1995 made by Brisbane's rock drummer Lindy Morrison called Australian Women in Rock and Pop. The comparisons are... well, a little startling.
We have co-creator of the film and self-taught music photographer Michelle Grace Hunder here to chat about the making of the documentary. Hi there, Michelle.
Hi, how are you going? Thanks for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. So could you tell us, how did this project start?
Oh, it's actually quite a long-winded story, but essentially I've been shooting in the music industry for about 8 years and had definitely noticed a gender disparity, specifically in the scene that I was shooting in, which was hip-hop at that time. And when I started to look outside my own little bubble, I actually noticed that the disparity was actually across the whole industry, and not only just artists, but producers and behind the scenes. And there was a lot of conversation happening about, I guess, the statistics, and that there was this glaring gap, but no one was really talking about why. Like, why is this happening? Like, actually speaking to the artists, trying to delve a little bit different, a little bit deeper than, I guess, the surface of, okay, yes, we can all see that there's a problem, because, you know, only, I think it's APRA, registered with APRA is women make up 20%. So it's like, it's quite a big disparity. So I just wanted to explore those reasons why.
Yeah, it's so low, women in music, and they drop off so sharply after the age of, I think it's 22. So when you reached out to these artists, what were their reactions when they heard what you were doing?
It was mixed, to be honest. I think a lot of the younger women were super keen to be involved and, you know, I guess put their perspectives across. I guess women that have been in the industry for a little bit longer were, some of them were a little bit more hesitant. Like, some of them were just, I guess, sick of talking about the issue. Just like, why are we still having this conversation? And it took a little while to convince them that this was a different narrative that we actually wanted to, you know, explore it a little bit deeper, rather than just saying like, oh, what's it like to be a woman in music, which is what they get asked all the time. But actually, you know, speaking to the reasons why there is such a drop-off, and any barriers that I guess they face. And also, these women are, you know, they're really successful. So they're not victims. They are just actually just getting along with, getting on with it. And a lot of the barriers that are there, they've had to kind of jump over, but also just, you know, they're succeeding. So, yeah, there was some resistance in some instances, but, like, overall, it was really, really well supported. And I think especially when they saw the actual documentary, it's been like overwhelmingly positive, and the women have been so supportive, which is awesome.
Amazing. So, Michelle, I'd love to hear, what are some of the recurring stories or themes you heard doing this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the biggest thing, the overarching thing is, I think the confidence issue for young women, that, you know, especially around the ages of, you know, around 18 to kind of 22, there is such a huge lack of confidence, and a lot of little things that maybe, and big things as well, can really deter women from continuing in the industry. So I think what we really found is, like, actually just talking to other women and not seeing them as competition, because a lot of women isolate themselves sometimes and feel like they have to be the very best at anything before they'll present their art. And that was also another thing that we saw, is women all have to, they really think that they have to be the best of the best. And so anything below that, sometimes I guess their confidence is rocked a little bit. So I guess getting around other women and saying, hey, we also have these issues as well, and getting around and, I guess, support within the community, we've found has been really helpful. But it also can be little things like, you know, you might rock up to a gig and there's a sound person there, and it could be just an off-the-cuff remark about, you know, do you know where this is plugs in, or, you know, you're giving them feedback about what you're hearing, and they're not believing you, or they're not even coming to listen to what your issues are. Like, little, it sounds kind of silly, but, like, you know, if you get that repeatedly, that's, like, really rocking to the core of, like, I am an artist, I know what I'm talking about, why do you continue to patronise me? So, yeah, there's a lot of those sort of things. And then there's bigger issues, like, once women become mothers, it's really tricky. There's underlying racial issues, identity issues. So, yeah, it's very multi-layered, multifaceted. There's not one thing, I guess. It's a multitude of lots of different things.
But it all adds up. You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5 FM with Swetha Das and Amber Schultz. We're chatting to Michelle Grace Hunder about her documentary, Her Sound, Her Story, which is out this Friday. I wanted to ask what your thoughts on female competition in the music industry is. Does it exist, and how is it portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's got better in terms of being pitted up against each other, if that's what you mean, like women being in competition with each other. It definitely was something that we found with women, I guess women that have been around a little bit longer, and they definitely found that they were continually pitted up against each other by the media, by their own, you know, sometimes management or labels, to be like, you know, there's only one Missy Higgins, or there's only, you know, one Tina Arena, or like there can't be any other space for women at that time. And I do really think that that's definitely changed. But you still see that, you know, I constantly call stuff out on Twitter that I see. It's like, you know, who's the current queen of hip-hop? It's like, why does there need to be one queen? Why can't there be, you know, a multitude of queens?
A team of queens.
Exactly.
So I think, look, I do definitely think that it's getting better. What is, I think the changing the thought process for women to know you're actually not all in competition with each other. There's enough space. Work together. Women in collaboration is just so powerful. I've definitely seen that myself recently, not only through what we've done with Her Sound, which has been this huge bringing together of community, but there's been a few other things that I've been involved in that's been kind of women-only spaces or non-binary and gender non-conforming and creating spaces where people really flourish. And it's really beautiful to watch.
So, you know, we do have to wrap up, Michelle. It's been amazing speaking to you. But just to end the show, you know, you mentioned collaboration has been key here. Just quickly, what more needs to change in the industry to foster a better relationship here?
I think the first thing is just actually awareness. So that I hope that's how the film really, I guess, challenges people's perceptions of what the issues are. Because I think if you don't actually know or believe that there's an issue, there can be no change. So I think by watching the film, you see, you know, close to 50 women that, you know, are speaking about the same issue. So it's like very hard to argue against that many collective voices. So yeah, I would say awareness is the key thing.
Thank you so much for talking with us this morning, Michelle.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Michelle Grace Hunder, co-creator of Her Sound, Her Story, a documentary exploring women's voices and experiences in the Aussie music industry. The film is available online from Friday, so be sure to check it out.
Well, that's all we've got for the show today. Another big thanks to our producers, Eden Faithful, Natalie Sokolowska, and Pip Leeson. And thanks again to our guests, Dr. Nicole Lee, Michael Rodriguez, and Michelle Grace Hunder. And one final call up for our wonderful supporter drive. Don't forget to call in to support FBI Radio on 833-22-945. We are completely volunteer run. We support local artists, and it's a great station to support. That's 833-22-945.
We'll catch you next week, but before we do, we're going to play a track from Sampa the Great's new album, The Return.
Yes, that's right. Here's Freedom. See you all next week.